Jeffersonville. W233 AH Monticello.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, across the country, advocates are pushing for stricter PFAS regulation to prevent those harmful chemicals from further contaminating drinking water sources. Radio Catskill reporter Marin Scott spoke to Newburgh residents Jennifer Rawlinson about Newburgh's main water source, which is contaminated with the chemicals, and Shannon Roback, director of science at Riverkeeper. Have you noticed geese flying back recently, or robins plucking worms from your snowless yard in the middle of winter? Locally and globally, bird populations and migration patterns are changing. On his Radio Catskill podcast, Close to Home, Leif Johansson is asking why. And Amberly Jane Campbell, publisher of the Shawangunk Journal, has quit the news and crossed over to a public job as Ulster County's assistant deputy county executive. We'll hear from her. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A ceasefire deal remains elusive in the Israel-Hamas war. There don't seem to be any negotiations today, like recent discussions involving representatives from Hamas, Egypt, and Qatar. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is rejecting criticism from President Biden. The president said Netanyahu was hurting Israelis by pursuing policies that have killed many Palestinians. Biden also said that Israel should not conduct a military operation against the southern Gaza city of Rafah. NPR's Daniel Estrin says the Israeli military has not made a large move there.
On the question of an Israeli operation in Rafah, you know, Israeli military analysts don't see that as being something imminent. The U.S., of course, doesn't want to see it happen. Any kind of big military operation now can threaten the potential for a hostage release deal. And, you know, Israel's military assets really are focused outside of Gaza right now.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is heading to Jamaica today for a high-level emergency meeting on Haiti. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports gangs have been preventing Haiti's prime minister from returning to the country.
The U.S. has been working with CARICOM, a regional group of Caribbean countries, to encourage Prime Minister Ariel Henry to agree to a transition plan for Haiti's government. The hope is that this could lead the way to elections and to the deployment of a Kenyan-led international force, which the U.N. approved last year. Secretary Blinken will be discussing all this at the CARICOM meeting in Jamaica. He'll also meet with Jamaica's prime minister during the hastily arranged day trip. Over the weekend, the U.S. evacuated some staff from its embassy in Haiti and added more security for the remaining diplomats in the country. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
President Biden is releasing his proposed budget today. It's a wish list unlikely to pass Congress because Republicans control the House. One item calls for cutting the national deficit by increasing taxes on more affluent Americans. Stocks open lower this morning as investors wait for updated news about inflation. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 130 points in early trading.
The Labor Department is set to report tomorrow on consumer prices for February. Forecasters expect to see some easing of so-called core inflation, which strips out volatile food and energy prices. Headline inflation could be somewhat higher for the month, though. Gasoline prices have been climbing in recent weeks, although they're still down from this time last year. Lower energy prices cut into profits for Saudi Arabia's oil company. Saudi Aramco earned $121 billion last year, down from an eye-popping $161 billion in 2022. Boeing stock opened lower this morning after news the Justice Department has launched a criminal investigation into the mid-air blowout in January of a door plug on a Boeing 737. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. States that use the Colorado River face a deadline today. From member station KUNC, Alex Hager reports state officials appear unable to agree on one plan to manage the shrinking water supply in the future.
The Biden administration wants the seven states to move quickly and arrive at a consensus about river rules to regulate water use by the end of the year, in case they lose the White House in November. But right now, the states that use Colorado River water are divided. Two competing proposals were unveiled last week with fundamental differences in how to spread out the pain of water shortages caused by climate change. The river has been drying up for more than two decades, and the Southwest needs to cut back on demand. But tensions tensions run high since the river flows to 40 million people in cities like Denver and Los Angeles, as well as sprawling farm fields, 30 Native American tribes, and lots of fish and wildlife, including endangered species. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Phoenix.
Today is the 13th anniversary of Japan's earthquake and tsunami that devastated the region of Fukushima. The disaster included the nuclear power plant. About 20,000 people died in the earthquake and tsunami. The nuclear reactor has left parts of the area uninhabitable. The holy month of Ramadan began for many Muslims last night after officials in Saudi Arabia reported sighting the crescent moon. Muslims spend the month reflecting on their faith and gathering with family. They also fast during daylight hours. A key focus during Ramadan are acts of kindness and charity. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Since 2016, Newburgh's main water source, Washington Lake, has been contaminated with PFAS chemicals. That's a group of chemicals that don't break down naturally, coining the name Forever Chemicals. In Newburgh and across the country, advocates are pushing for stricter PFAS regulation to prevent these harmful chemicals from further contaminating drinking water sources. Radio Catskill reporter Maren Scotton spoke to Newburgh resident Jennifer Rawlinson and Shannon Robach, the director of science at Riverkeeper, about these forever chemicals.
Until 2016, Jennifer Rawlinson had never heard of PFAS. As a mother and lifelong Newburgh resident, she was mostly concerned with lead contamination at her children's school, or the seemingly never-ending list of pollution issues in the Hudson River. But while attending a political rally almost 8 years ago, Rawlinson found out her community's water source, Washington Lake, was contaminated with a group of chemicals called PFAS, widely known as forever chemicals.
At the beginning, obviously, there was just like the puzzling, what is it? And then it was sort of like, well, what does this mean? You know, as a parent, I think, and especially as a mother, you know, you're carrying a baby and it's sort of like every move or decision you make somehow is impacting your kid. It almost makes you automatically like guilt-ridden. Eat that processed meat or cheese? If the food's not organic, if I have the munchies and need McDonald's chicken nugget, you know, what's that? Am I setting them up for failure? But then to kind of realize like something as basic as water, could ultimately impact them. You just kind of wonder, you look at them growing up and you wonder any little hiccups or things that are coming out and you go, well, is this having to do with that or is it personality? Is it, you know, his medical history of the family? You know, but if your family's been living here for decades, is it really a hereditary ailment or is it actually an environmental ailment?
It's estimated that half of public water systems in the country have PFAS contamination. In New York State, PFAS contamination has been found in several communities, including Hoosick Falls, Petersburg, and Newburgh. Last year, Radio Catskill investigated PFAS contamination at Sullivan County International Airport. Across the country, advocates and experts alike are warning of the dangerous effects of PFAS and pushing for urgent regulatory action. Shannon Robach, the science director at Riverkeeper, explains why PFAS chemicals are so problematic.
It's a family of chemicals, and they are in this sort of category of something we would call a persistent pollutant, which just means that they are very difficult to biodegrade. And because of that, they are difficult to remove from the environment once they are released into the environment, which inevitably happens with chemicals as they make their way into consumer products, either as part of the waste stream during manufacture or as they break down in landfills. And so this family of chemicals, they have a similar chemical structure, a chain of carbons with a fluorine atom, different number of carbons make different types of PFAS, but basically what they all have in common are that they are pretty good at repelling water. And so that property has made them very useful in certain consumer products like Teflon, nonstick pans, Scotch Guard and other water repellent sprays, in fabrics that need to be water repellent, in firefighting foams. So they've been really widely used in consumer products. I mean, even food packaging where you're trying to like line paper so that, you know, the paper doesn't degrade when your food is wet. So they've been kind of like this miracle of chemistry, you know, before we understood the negative health effects was great because we could use it in all kinds of consumer products. But unfortunately, we now know that, different chemicals in this family can cause reproductive health effects. They can cause cancer. They can cause liver toxicity. They can cause things like high cholesterol. So there's really a number of different negative health outcomes associated with exposure to these chemicals. And they're at this point, because they don't break down in the environment and because they've been so widely used in consumer products, they're just kind of everywhere.
In Newburgh, the PFAS contamination in Washington Lake stemmed from a firefighting foam spill at the Stewart Air National Guard base. Since contamination was discovered in 2016, a series of investigations at the base have been ongoing. But Newburgh residents have seen little to no action. The city switched to the Catskill Aqueduct as its main water source, the same water source that serves New York City. But Rollison says it's not a permanent solution.
I'm also involved with the National PFAS Coalition, so I'm in circles with other impacted communities around the nation, and you'll find that it's a very unbalanced, unfair way in which communities can all be facing the same thing from the same culprit, which may be military or industrial. Mm-hmm. And yet our outcomes are totally different because of resources or just how a state regulates. And I always say and feel this, that thank God I'm living in New York, because at least, you know, it's not everything, but we definitely are above some other states in the idea of like protecting our residents. And so I argue about, you know, right now the Stewart Air Force Base is filtering water that goes through their system because they're trying to reduce the contamination going off base. And my thing to them is, well, what is happening to the media that you're collecting, the PFAS that's collected in these filters? And they ship them off to another state. I don't know if consciously, you know, I can know that contamination that we've already been exposed to should just be shipped off and burned somewhere else for another community to bear, which right. is probably darker and poorer than ours and has little say just because their government, their state reps don't feel it's an issue.
To really get to the root of the issue, Roback says stricter regulation is needed. Otherwise, PFAS will keep being produced. In February, lawmakers and advocates gathered at the state capitol in Albany to call for state legislation to control harmful PFAS chemicals. Without these stricter regulations, advocates warn the public health consequences will only get worse.
We really have to get at the source and prevent these chemicals from being used in products, because if we try to just focus on improving drinking water treatment plants and wastewater treatment plants, improving that infrastructure, it's really, really expensive and it doesn't work as well right. as just not putting those things into products and into the economy in the first place.
To fight for the well-being of her community, Rollison joined the Newburgh Clean Water Project, a coalition of Newburgh residents advocating for long-term access to clean drinking water and health resources for those who have been impacted by PFAS contamination.
I may not be able to physically fix the problem out there where it's contaminated, but if no one's persistent and loud and making space for themselves in these forums, we soon become forgotten. Becomes a science project for engineers and for, you know, the health regulators. It doesn't become about the people who are actually impacted.
That was Jennifer Rollison and Shannon Roback on PFAS contamination in Newburgh, New York. In Liberty, I'm Maren Scotton for Radio Catskill.
There's more information at riverkeeper.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, birds are staying put or migrating shorter distances because temperatures have risen during the colder months in the region. On his WJFF podcast, Close to Home, Leif Johansson is asking why. Right after this, this is Radio Catskill.
We were up in the woods.
Whoops.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, what kind of inspiration should we take from the life and work of the physicist Richard Feynman?
You know, the great thing is to be endlessly curious.
And how has Google's search monopoly affected what we see online?
It's quite lucrative for them to auction off those slots, and it's not always with the customer's best interests in mind.
It's next time on Freakonomics Radio, Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Have you noticed geese flying back recently or robins plucking worms from your snowless yard in the middle of winter? Locally and globally, bird populations and migration patterns are changing. On his Radio Catskill podcast, Close to Home, Leif Johansson is asking why. He spoke to Dr. Andrew Farnsworth, Senior Research Associate in the Center for Avian Population Studies at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, Mark Didia, President of the John Burroughs Natural History Society, and Wendy Taki, Regional Coordinator for the 3rd New York State Breeding Bird Atlas. But his curiosity about these changing migration patterns started on a walk with his dad.
We were up in the woods near his house in White Sulphur Springs recently, and he starts talking about birds. Actually, one particular bird, a robin. And my dad, for some context, is a retired high school earth science teacher, and he is someone who pays attention to his surroundings. And this robin was pretty concerning to him, because it wasn't so much about what he saw, but when he saw it. It was in early February, in his backyard. For the last few years, he has seen more and more robins in the middle of winter, and winters in the area have become noticeably more mild. Now, an experienced birder listening to this might point out that American robins don't actually migrate out of any of the lower 48 states over the winter. They often just make regional movements to follow sources of food. And they would be right. But these omnivores do seem to have more access to winter food in our neck of the woods recently. A few days after he saw the robin, he saw Canada geese flying back to the area and paddling around local lakes, which have more open water than they used to over the winter. That, he told me, just didn't sit right. And this got me thinking about that old canary in a coal mine saying, originating from when miners would bring canaries in bird cages down into coal mines with them, and because of the bird's small size and rapid breathing rate and high metabolism, they would die before the miners would if there was too much carbon monoxide in the air, giving miners enough time to get out of there. In case you're curious, by the way, this was a standard practice in coal mining from 1911 all the way until 1986. Anyway, I digress. Birds are not only an important part of a healthy ecosystem, a staple of the global ecotourism sector, and a multi-billion dollar element of our food supply, because yes, chickens and turkeys are birds too, they are also a valuable bellwether. And before we see mass migration of human beings because of a shift in climate, we're going to see it happen with birds first. And we're already seeing some of this happen, not just in my dad's backyard, but in more reliable scientific studies with long-term, large-sample data analysis. A study from 2021 examined 50 years of migratory patterns for a range of African birds and found that they are spending less and less time in their warm African winter retreats and more time back in Europe as it gets warmer there. Another study from the same year found that Richard's pipits, a common bird in Siberia, tend not to migrate to their former winter homes in southern Asia, and are instead migrating on an east-to-west axis. A 2022 study found that the availability of aquatic insects in upstate New York is now earlier in the year and peaking over a shorter period of time than it did a few decades ago, which causes shifts in the timelines of bird migration and breeding as a result. And the list goes on and on. So today, let's talk about birds. And as it so happens, upstate New York is home to some of the world's leading ornithologists, thanks in large part to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology at Cornell University. So the other day, I spoke with Dr. Andrew Farnsworth, Senior Research Associate in the Center for Avian Population Studies at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, to get a better sense of how bird populations and migratory patterns are changing and why. I started out by asking Dr. Farnsworth how scientists go about measuring and studying bird migration patterns.
In some ways, it's very simple. There is an element of studying migration, which is all about observation as a human that we do with our eyes and our ears and understanding over time how patterns change with what we see and hear. Obviously, because migration happens over such large spatial extents and long periods of time in many respects, and obviously changes over those times, we also need to use other tools, not just more people for, you know, more eyes and ears, but also what we call remote sensing methods. So other kinds of indirect ways of studying and extending our capabilities. For example, radar is one that we use. Weather surveillance radar is great at detecting, obviously, meteorological phenomena in the atmosphere. It also happens to be very good at detecting biological phenomena like bird migration and when birds are aloft. So using those kinds of tools, like radar, for example, we can extend our capabilities that our eyes and ears have just from one point in space where, say, I am, to an entire continental scale with a network of radars. So that's one of the ways we study it. Of course, there are a few others, a whole array of them, but that's an example.
Is the consensus that climate change is impacting bird migration patterns in some way? And if so, by how much?
Yeah, so climate change definitely impacts bird migration. And in fact, at the grandest scales where we think about, you know, evolutionary timescales and geological timescales, the whole notion that bird migration exists is because of changing climate, right? And the distribution of food resources and habitat that tracks that changing climate over time. So there's a very close relationship between birds migrating and changing climate. So it's a very good way of actually understanding, you know, in this current phase in which we exist, you know, how human impacts to, you know, enhancing and making more extreme these climate changes impact bird migration. Great, great way to study it. And really, it's all about the idea that when birds are in a particular place at a particular time, they're using certain kinds of resources. If it's habitat for nesting, or if it's food to produce offspring, or whatever it is. And that can be related back to what we call sort of first principles of the sun's energy in a particular place that creates the climatic patterns that we have and how those change. Obviously, we know they change over time. And we know specifically that in the last 100 to 200 years, those patterns of changing climate are dramatically enhanced. And we've seen, obviously, some radical extremes happen just in the past year. And birds respond to that. Birds are really good indicators of those kinds of changes. I mean, the whole canary in the coal mine euphemism is very meaningful. It's true. You know, birds are sensitive to their environment. And because we can see and hear them very clearly and study them, you know, using whether it's, you know, observations from that I make or colleagues or these remote sensing methods, we can study those changes and that the connections to the way birds behave and where they are on the planet has some really great insight for us into how climate is changing and what those impacts look like.
Have you seen specific examples in New York State of species shifting when they're migrating, where they're migrating, and perhaps population trends more broadly here?
Yeah, the species shifts and the shifts in timing and the distribution of birds in New York in particular, some of the most striking examples, there are some for migration, but some of the most striking ones relate to winter distributions of birds and birds that are now spending time, for example, in New York State during winter periods, where in the past they would have migrated elsewhere farther south. A whole range of species, for example, some waterfowl like Canada geese, turkey vulture, a raptor, obviously. These species are now regularly occurring in New York State in the winter, whereas, you know, even 20, 30 years ago, finding a turkey vulture, for example, or even finding large numbers of Canada geese would be sort of like a red letter moment in some respects. Other species like, for example, short distance migrants, birds that may breed or pass through the New York State area, but will spend the winters typically, say, in the southeastern U.S., so not very long distance migrants, but say migrating within the U.S., what we call shorter distance migrants or even facultative migrants, birds that really move when they have to. We see pretty dramatic changes in those distributions, even on a year-to-year basis. Like if it's a warm winter, for example, or if it's going to be a warm spring like this one is forecast to be, the expectation that those birds will track those changes and arrive earlier because, of course, the warm wave is happening to the south and increasing, you know, moving farther north. So species like Eastern Phoebe arriving, you know, significantly earlier some years, we see those kinds of patterns too. Now, there are a number of other things, you know, there's a diversity of birds that occurs annually in New York State that's between 300 and 400 species. So there are lots and lots of patterns we see here. But no question, we see these kinds of changes on the basis particularly of the distributions in winter, but also of these short distance migrants that are really tuned into changes that are occurring like on a seasonal basis almost, or, you know, sort of like the anomalies that we see this spring versus last spring. Do we see patterns that are kind of longer term? Like, for example, you know, new birds arriving in New York State that didn't breed there before. We see those kinds of things too, no question. Sort of the creep northward, the expansion that's associated with climate change also. So all of these different kinds of flavors of what it means for climate change impacts and bird distributions, we see those things.
For any species that are here year round that aren't migrating to some extent, have we seen changes in their behavior or populations given that the climate they are used to may no longer exist?
The changes that we see for more resident birds that are really not necessarily migrants or moving only very, very short distances, sort of dispersing, we certainly see changes there too. They're different though, obviously, in terms of thinking, what's the timing of breeding? What's the timing of producing offspring? How far are birds going based on what habitats are available, or how are populations expanding or contracting locally because of that? Those kinds of things, sometimes they're a little bit harder to tease out because, of course, resident birds, there's no necessarily immediate pulse of an arrival or departure. Obviously, they're present all the time. So you have to tune into some other different kinds of attributes in order to understand what's happening. When do you start hearing the first songs, and where do you start hearing them? You know, when and where do you start seeing young birds, you know, that are fledging from the nest? These patterns where birds are breeding earlier, that's something we also see in New York State as well. Does it also mean that some birds are sort of getting pushed out of the state because temperatures are increasing? We're losing, for example, high elevation habitats, or those are changing dramatically. Probably if we haven't seen that, we're going to start to see that soon. And of course, all of this is is really confounded, but also kind of enhanced by other patterns that are happening, changes in human use and land use and loss of habitat that's kind of separate from climate change. So sometimes it's really hard to tease apart exactly, well, what is the response to climate change versus what is a response to actually what's happening for residents in particular to very local habitat conditions that are more driven not by a change in climate, but by a change in the way humans are using a particular or not using a particular agricultural area or developing, you know, more built environment or that kind of situation.
Obviously, in the last 50, 60 years, there's been more of a focus on environmental conservation and being mindful of preserving our environment for other species that are here just besides ourselves. Are there any human activities specifically, though, that are happening more now that you're concerned about with their impact on our birds?
Yeah, there are a couple that, talking about migration in particular, there are really two or three human activities or human-related activities that are primary drivers that are things, for example, that we can control if we just change our behaviors a little bit. One relates to, as I mentioned, the built environment and more structures and more glass, you know, like you can see in a city or in, you know, any kind of a construction of a house, even glass that is not treated for so that birds can see it, so that they can perceive that it's a solid object rather than some reflection or something that they can fly through. That's a serious problem. Collisions kill, you know, hundreds of millions of birds every year in the U.S. And treating the windows and sort of the expansion of the built environment and these windows and glass surfaces that are not treated is a serious issue. I mean, that's a huge number of birds that are killed every year in these collisions. And there is some relationship of light pollution to that too. So reducing the light pollution that attracts and disorients birds migrating at night when most movements happen, and treating the glass so that birds can see it, those are primary ways that we can address some problems that are really, like, over the last 50 to 60 years expanding dramatically as humans, you know, sort of expand their impact, their footprint, if you will, in that sort of built environment and more structures and new houses. And it's not just skyscrapers. It's also single story and low story buildings as well. Another example that's a little bit less direct with the human activity, but relates to where humans are, is cats, right? Is feral cats. Like, keeping cats inside is a huge win for saving birds, because cats kill a huge number of birds every year that are, you know, outdoor cats. And keeping them inside is a really, really big win. I mean, talking about like 1 to 2 billion birds killed every year because of outdoor cats, right? One way or another, whether they're feral or house cats that are lit outside, keeping them inside is a direct win. And it, again, that connection of where humans are to where these animals are and their impacts, that's another thing that we've seen dramatically increase in terms of the problem, the challenges for bird populations in the past, say, half century. And some of these are declined with, you know, many people have seen and been alarmed by the publication a couple of years ago that highlighted, you know, a 3 billion bird loss over 50 years, you know, of breeding populations, basically, you know, taking these birds out of the system, dramatic declines, like, you know, basically 1 out of every 4 birds, you know, I mean, really, really huge impacts. And connected with that are these kinds of changes with human land use and the built environment, things that go along with where humans are, like cats, obviously the habitat piece and the climate change piece and other things and pollution. But those are just some examples of the kinds of changes we've seen over the last, you know, 50 to 60 years in particular that have these kinds of impacts. And I mentioned the built environment with glass and light and cats in particular, because those are all things that, as a homeowner, as a pet owner, as someone who works in a business, you can make changes to those things and actually have a positive impact. Whereas the large amount of land change or, you know, sort of preserving big chunks of land or making changes to, you know, larger scale actions to reduce increasing temperatures, those are bigger scale challenges. And acting as an individual, it's a little bit harder to see your impacts. But with the glass, light, and cats, that's something that individuals could do.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear more from Leif Johansson's WJFF podcast, Close to Home.
are examining changing bird migration patterns. And when we come back, how migration timing is affected by climate change and how worried should we be? This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear some jungle jive and some jungle drums, plus the Exotica classic by Les Baxter, Ritual of the Savage. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Let's get back to Leif Johansson and his podcast, Close to Home. We're asking why, locally and globally, bird populations and migration patterns are changing. Leif is speaking with Dr. Andrew Farnsworth. He's the Senior Research Associate in the Center for Avian Population Studies at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
How worried should we be about changes in bird populations, whether it's changes in migratory patterns or just a loss of birds altogether, whether it's certain species or just a large part of species? Obviously, we all play some role in the broader ecosystem that we live in. If all of a sudden there are certain bird species that are no longer a part of our ecosystem, is that bad news, you know, radiating out in other ways?
I think there are three different sort of parallel reasons to be worried about declining bird populations, to be concerned. One is that, yeah, birds do occupy a very particular place in ecosystems, and they cross ecosystems. They are pollinators. They provide other ecosystem services. They control pests. You know, they're participants in these structures, these food webs, these chains that are interconnected. So as we lose those elements of populations and those pieces, those connections, there can be some potentially serious problems, and we need to be mindful of that. Birds are these great ecological indicators, right? So being sensitive to that is important. I think also we want to be mindful from the perspective of birds' ability to connect us with the world around and be connected to nature through them. The whole idea of even hearing bird songs, being outside and experiencing, you know, watching birds, that connection to nature is a critically important element, I think. And losing that element says something at a much kind of greater scale for what that means about our experience with the world around us, losing connection with it. And I think that's a really fundamental point to remember, is that birds sort of allow us to be drawn into the world when we hear them, when we see them. They do cool stuff. They're really generally easy to find. So that connectedness is also a really important piece. And then of course, you know, there's, I think, another dimension in particular when it comes to some areas of the U.S., parts of New York State included, in that there is a serious financial gain, you know, from people going to see birds. I mean, something close to 100 million people in the U.S. are either interested enough in birds or going out to participate, like, almost on a daily basis. And there are a lot of dollars. There are billions of dollars involved in that. So some places where birds are present, people are going to go and spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of money, and a lot of thought, and a lot of connection to particular places. So there's that element too, you know, sort of just trying to think about the connection to the human element and why we would care about it. Beyond those three kinds of things, well, obviously, these organisms have a right to exist in their own, and there's a whole endeavor of, you know, sort of their plight, right? And the existence in terms of the evolutionary history, what's changed over the last, you know, much shorter scale of time, and there's a series of arguments that exists there too, as well, that is equally powerful. But that human connection piece, and why we should care about it, I think those are really strong reasons. You know, you think about the current state of the world and the evolution of all this amazing technology that extends our you know, capabilities to sense and survey the world. I think it's really important that we balance how we use that to gather as much information as we can and learn as much as we can, you know, really like the pursuit of science and then turning that into knowledge. But that at the core, you know, we want to make sure that we stay connected to our eyes and ears and the experiences that we have outside, you know, and staying connected enough to that to be outside and to be inspired by it and be moved by it and have concern. You know, I think that balance of technology and human experience is a really important one to remember now as we go farther and farther into the technological world and advance with, you know, new kinds of information gathering, new kinds of visuals, new kinds of tools, smartphones that do everything. It's important to make sure that we use our eyes and ears and actually, you know, remember what it is to be connected.
So, who is getting connected to our natural world through birding locally? Well, there are a handful of organizations that gather data on the bird populations of our region, and I thought it might be interesting to check in with one to get a better understanding of how people actually go about this process of observing the evolving behaviors and activities of birds. So I got in touch with the folks at the John Burroughs Natural History Society in Ulster County, New York. And not only does this organization have a long history of birding, but one of the people involved with the society also happens to be the regional coordinator of the third New York State Breeding Bird Atlas. I was joined for this conversation by Mark Dede, the current president of the John Burroughs Natural History Society, and Wendy Tachi, a regional breeding bird atlas coordinator. And I started by asking Wendy to tell me more about what this atlas is and how it works. And by the way, throughout this recording, you're going to hear a lot of birds in the background. That's because when Mark Dede isn't serving in his capacity as president of the John Burroughs Natural History Society, he's working at the Forsyth Nature Center, where he cares for a lot of birds. He was calling in from that center when we spoke.
Basically, New York State has been broken up into blocks based on the USGS topo quad. And a couple of those within each topo quad, it's been split up further. So in each of them, there are two blocks that are considered priority blocks. So when we started the study, you know, we wanted two of those priority blocks in each of the quads covered very completely. And what coverage means is you go out to a block, mindful that you're in the priority block. You observe breeding behavior. So there's a range of breeding behavior from sort of lower codes. So if you hear a bird singing, that's related to breeding and attracting a mate and determining one's territory. So that's a possible code. And then there's kind of a gradation of codes. So the ultimate challenge, you know, the ultimate observation is to confirm breeding. So that could be fledglings in a nest. It could be a bird carrying food. So go out, get in your block, you code the species that you've observed, and you enter them into eBird, which is an application developed by Cornell, and it's a way to collect data about birds and observations. And it's a very large data set. Data is collected globally. Lots of birders are used to entering an eBird, so that's the way the Atlas is collecting the data to then use to, you know, for studies and conservation and to tell what's happening to species in the state, how their distribution's changing, are they doing well, are they not doing well. Currently, there are 3,788 atlasers across New York State who are out collecting this data.
And that was an excerpt from Close to Home, Leif Johansson's Radio Catskill podcast about changing bird migrations. You can hear the rest of the podcast and all of his podcasts at our website, wjffradio.org. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, former news publisher Amberly Jane Campbell is now the new Ulster County Assistant Deputy County Executive. We'll hear from her next. This is Radio Catskill.
For some combat veterans, the 4th of July is the toughest day of the year.
The loud noise is associated with something horrific and dangerous. And now any unpredictable loud noise can create the same response, whether it's a slamming door or fireworks.
How fear hijacks our minds, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger has appointed Amberly Jane Campbell to the position of Assistant Deputy County Executive. Campbell will lead the communications and community outreach work of the County Executive's office. Previously, Campbell served as publisher of the Schwankuk Journal, co-founder of Kingston Wire, and before that, an on-air reporter for Capital Radio and Audible Broadcasting Company. She spoke with Patricia Rubio about her new political role and her start in journalism.
I made my first homemade newspaper at 8 years old, and I was always interested in what was going on with everybody, and it was just a natural thing that happened. And right out of high school, I got a job at WPDH, WCZX, and WEOK, and I was on the radio for them, and I also worked in the newsroom, and so that was like a taste of radio news. And I was there for quite a few years and interviewed a lot of people through election night, all kinds of things. And that was a great time. And I've always just been interested in the human animal. And I think that we're endlessly fascinating. And so after that, I worked at the Millbrook Roundtable, which is now defunct. Unfortunately, it was with Taconic Press, which was in Millbrook. And I was a reporter there, and I worked my way up to managing editor. And my first story there was, unfortunately, the death of a horse. Got into a car accident. A car hit the horse. And that was like, that was my first kind of real news story that I wrote for the Millbrook Roundtable. And I was there through 9/11. And when 9/11 happened, we lost a lot of people in the community, a lot of firefighters, a lot of parents of kids, and et cetera like that. And I was still young in my early 20s, and I decided that I should see the country and get out of Dodge. And so I got in my car and I just started driving, and I went cross country for a year and a half, and I was homeless a lot of the time, and I had a lot of great adventures, and I had a lot of close calls. It was 100% a good experience. I got very fortunate. And then I came back to go to Stony Brook University in 2003. And yeah, things went from there.
And he ended up being working for the Schwankuk Journal and eventually becoming the publisher for Schwankuk Journal. How long were you at the Journal?
Yeah, so I had been doing the radio news at Capital Broadcasting and Audible, and that was like a fixed 4-year contract. And so the 4-year contract ended in like late 2006. And I was looking on Craigslist and I saw this ad for publisher of the Schwankuk Journal, which I'd never heard of the publication. And I called and I had a really long discussion with Alex Schiffer, you know, who's the owner. And we had a great talk. And so I came in and interviewed, and that was that.
Having this career in journalism, what motivated you to have this transition into governmental communications role? And how do you think you anticipate your background in journalism and community outreach will influence your approach in this new position as the Assistant Deputy County Executive?
I've been at the SJ for 7 years, and I co-founded The Wire in 2020. And so that's a long time. And I was there for a good amount of time, and I love the communities. And I was just doing the business and meeting the people and shaking the hands and kissing the babies and making good articles happen and all the things that go along with it. And honestly, I didn't really think about pursuing another role anywhere. And it was out of the blue that our Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger gave me a ring one Sunday evening, and she offered me the position, and she just thought I would fit in really well and do a great job. And I decided to take the plunge because of the several factors. I have to say a lot of it was financial, and just I have a pension now, which is amazing to me. I really always thought that I would work until I died. And now I have a vision plan. I have a dental plan. Like, I have all these things, which you get as a county employee. And of course, I really had and have a lot of respect for Jen. And I just think that she's an incredible person. And it's, if you were to conceive of a quote politician who was actually like a good person and really wanted to do well. And I know that sounds like really cliche, but she is. She's like the real deal. And the more that I'm here in the office at the county executives, I just really realized that she's amazing. And I just have increasing respect for her all the time. Now, what's great is that I do bring a lot to the team, in that having a background in local journalism, I can't imagine doing this job if I didn't have that. Number one, I already know about most of the issues that people are dealing with. I know all of the news stories that have come out about all of the things that it's really so much. Issues and initiatives and programs and grants and great people in the community and organizations and businesses. And it's just like this incredible mix. And I really had this incredible foundation and knowledge of all of these items and all of these topics. And so I'm coming into it also with a journalist's eye and a journalist's mind, so that I'm asking the right questions, and I'm really bolstering our team so that we know what to expect when we get press inquiries, which we get all the time. And most of the time they are on like topics that I have at least some knowledge about, but sometimes not. And I have to learn about all of these new things and everything. Thank goodness that I have the foundation that I have, and that I also know all kinds of key people in all the municipalities that we used to cover and that I used to cover. And so it's been a really great transition. And every day my knowledge base is like growing exponentially. Like, I leave work and my head is just like buzzing every day with knowledge.
So this sort of leads into my next question. You had this experience as a journalist in contacting other communication directors and other PR people. So how do you see your role influencing the relationship between Ulster County's government and local media outlets? Are there any kind of specific strategies you're considering to ensure that there's transparency and there's a foster productive relationship?
It's interesting. I've really gotten the whole range of reactions. Like, some people are very happy for me. Some local journalists that I worked with are very happy for me. And some were like, you went to the dark side. And there's an adversarial relationship in a way between the press and politicians, and as well there should be, because many politicians are not interested in transparency, and I am, and I have to say, journalists are, that's the name of the game. We want our local government to be transparent. That's the ideal. If you're not doing anything wrong, you don't care who knows about it. And some local journalists, one publication, like, the headline was that I went to the dark side. But, you know, for the people who knew me, who know me and know, you know, my struggles and everything, like, they're happy for me. So I do get it though. I absolutely get it. And journalists will always be suspicious of government and politicians. And I will always be suspicious of government and politicians. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to just always question authority. I, across the board, treat everyone with the utmost kindness and grace, because that's how I want to be treated. Even if somebody is short with me, or they don't like my answer to the question, or whatever it is, I'm still going to respond with kindness, because that's who I am.
Now that you're stepping into this role, you have any sort of immediate goals and priorities? I know you're still new to the job. I'm sure you're still absorbing everything that's going on. Do you have any sort of immediate goals or priorities for really boosting up the communications and the community outreach in Ulster County?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it is going to take me a little bit to get up to speed and really absorb everything. And a nonstop. I have to say, before I took this position, I feel like people who are not, I feel like it's easy to say, oh, government workers, they're just sitting on their butt all day doing nothing. It's easy to say that. But now that I'm in the position, I have to tell you that it is, you are constantly, there's constantly like people asking about things. There's constantly like social media posts and press releases that have to be written. It's just, it is so nonstop. And it's every kind of topic, every kind of municipality, this person from here, this business person, everybody wants to know things. So as I get up to speed with everything and also get acclimated to all the technology and all the ways that we communicate in house and the bureaucratic procedures for everything, that was something to get used to, let me tell you. But I do have a lot of plans for actively really engaging with the community. I really want to get out there. I'm starting next week to get out there and start meeting all the department heads of the county. And so I can really understand what they do better. And then I want to highlight some of those people and I want to highlight residents. And I want to maybe even do videos. And I have a lot of ideas for hopefully that I can start implementing like this summer. I'm going to events with Jen. I'm taking pictures. I'm like meeting a lot of the people. And then maybe I'm like, so Jen is great because she really like knows what she wants to say. And she writes a lot of her own things. Like I'm not putting words in her mouth. Like she writes a lot of what she's going to say, but I will research whatever it is that we're going to. We went to an EMS event and I researched just some, so she had some talking points. Participation has like decreased by 44% in the last 5 years. So just so she has some data to like intersperse with her genuine feelings.
Emily, before we go, you spoke about in the press release that your commitment to the public's right to know and the importance of engaging with the community. Looking ahead, what approaches do you envision introducing to, you mentioned some of them, digital, video, and social media, different ways to engage the different segments of Ulster County, since it is such a diverse community. How would you sort of engage them more effectively?
I think that the key is just, I would say balance, but I can't even say balance because there's just so many balls in the air. But I think that you have to be cognizant that you're really reaching all different segments and all different people, like especially underserved people. And also one of the reasons I was brought on is because I really have such a great knowledge of Ellenville and such a great knowledge of Southern Ulster County. And it was funny because there was an event that I didn't go to in Ellenville. It was an NAACP event. And Jen and Essie Lewis, our diversity chief, went to the event. And I guess apparently a lot of Ellenvillians came up to them and were like, you stole Amberley from us. But I'm just like serving in a greater capacity. But I think just we have to remember that I'm not going to be concentrating on the business owners and the big ticket organizations and like the people who are always in the headlines. We are the people. Like I'm committed to being accessible to like every person. And I really believe that are just like, I don't want to say our average citizens, like are just like our regular people. I'm a regular person. Like I just want to connect, you know, at a real level with real people so that they can feel like, wow, my government is actually like working for me. And actually I already did, which is great. I got a call from an Ellenville resident who would come into the paper every Thursday to buy the paper from me. And he said to me, there's a weird camera that got put on 209 and it looks like a license reader and nobody knows what it is. The local government doesn't know why it's there, who put it there, when. Right. So in my capacity, I was able to contact the DOT, contact somebody, and they were like, ooh, I don't know about that either. I'm going to find out about that for you. I called back the resident. I'm like, we're working on it. I'm trying to find something out for you. We got a little information, but we're waiting to get all of the information. And he was like, you're going to make me think the government works for me. And I was like, I want you to think that, you know? It's an ideal way to look at it, but I am who I am. So that's all I can be.
We were talking to the new assistant deputy county executive, Amberly Jane Campbell, former publisher of the Chuancong Journal. Amberly, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know about?
I just want to thank you for having me on. I really appreciate the time. And I've always been the kind of person that wants to serve the people. And I'm just going to keep doing it.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. Wind advisory in effect until 8. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.